introduce Nina. She is professor of history at Occidental College, the Anita Johnson Wand Chair of Women's Studies, and the author of The King's Midwife, A History and Mystery of Madame de Coudray, 1998. She's also the author, earlier, of Feminine and Opposition Journalism in Old Regime France, Le Journal de Dame, 1987. Both books won the Sierra Prize, and The King's Midwife also won the Biography Prize from the American Society of 18th Century Studies. And I'm very happy to introduce Nina Ratner-Gilbert.
Thank everybody for coming. I'm so happy to see you all here, and I thank Jim for getting in touch with me when he made this remarkable acquisition. He was like a kid in a candy shop. He was so excited about it, and so we had some wonderful exchanges. And I thank Pam for really co-curating or curating completely this wonderful exhibit, which is next door, and if you haven't had a chance to see it now, I'm assuming that door will be open after my talk. Because it's remarkable, the centerpiece and, of course, all the ambient material on the walls. And I want to thank the Zverina family for making this whole thing possible in the first place. So I'm just delighted to see everybody here. So Pam said she was so impressed with my looking around for letters, I should just say it was great fun. I mean, I have a day job. I'm a professor. But whenever I was free, whether it was summers or some stolen Easter break or whatever, I would go to France and go to the various departmental archives to find letters to Madame de Coudray, by Madame de Coudray, and about Madame de Coudray. And as I'll tell you in a minute, because hers was an official mission, there was really a lot of material to be found. So for me, doing this kind of scrounging around and digging was just pure, pure pleasure.
Can you speak up a bit?
Can I speak louder? I can speak about this loud. Is that going to work? Okay. So I want to start just by reading you a couple of quotations from women writers who I like very much, because I couldn't help thinking about Madame de Coudray when I read these things. Here's a quotation from Dorothy Sayers, the great crime writer. She said, "Time and trouble will tame an advanced young woman, but an advanced old woman is uncontrollable by any earthly force." And Isaac Dennison, the great Danish writer who wrote Out of Africa, among other things, wrote, "Women, when they are old enough to have done with the business of being women and can let loose their strength, must be the most powerful creatures in the world." So here's Madame de Coudray, who started this remarkable 30-year mission when she was already in her 40s, and she's the person I'm going to talk to you about today. So she was extraordinary, as I guess you can already figure out. But she's not just an extraordinary woman. She was an extraordinary midwife, a very, very skilled and enterprising midwife. And she was commissioned by two... Am I loud enough now? Is this loud enough? By two successive French monarchs, Louis XV and Louis XVI, to travel the country teaching peasant women the art of childbirth in an effort to arrest infant mortality, which was rampant, and increase the population of France. For nearly three decades, during the twilight of the old regime, this royal emissary covered the nation, teaching in over 40 cities and reaching, with the aid of a network of disciples whom she trained, an estimated 10,000 students. She wrote an illustrated textbook, L'abrégé de l'art des accouchements, one of the rare intrusions of a woman into the very patriarchal world of medical print culture. And she invented a life-size obstetrical mannequin for her demonstrations, one example of which still survives in the Musée Flaubert, a museum of the history of medicine in the city of Rouen. Hundreds of letters by her, to her, and about her, as I said before, scattered in departmental provincial archives all over the country, allowed me to reconstruct some of her story, and in any case, this mission that she was on, and I was able to sort of map it, as you'll see. And I was able to trace her pretty much until her death during the Reign of Terror in Bordeaux. She was in Bordeaux when she died. This mission, while it was, of course, not solely responsible for the demographic upswing of France after 1750, surely played a very significant part. I would dearly love to say that it was her single-handedly who was responsible for the population rise after 1750, but we must fairly mention that there were agricultural improvements that were really quite striking. There was the absence of plague, which some of you know of as the Black Death, which began in the 14th century, returned to Europe again and again in really terrible, devastating waves. But the last plague in France was in 1720 in the city of Marseille in the south of France. So after that, we didn't have these decimations of population that were so common up till then. So there are other reasons why France was growing during this period, but I like to think that she was very, very important in this regard. But from the start, I wondered who this woman really was, and I struggled to locate the private self inside this very public celebrity. Don't be scared. There's seats here. All along, I tried to recapture her interior journey as well, to get beyond the official documents and to problematize the very neat narrative that she tried to create in this paper trail. For she wanted her stunning accomplishment recorded, her obstetrical enlightenment and mobilization of an entire nation, and she did all in her power to see that it was. However, she kept her private self and her deep feelings pretty much secret, using very brisk, business-like, instrumental sort of letters to contain life's chaos. And this is why I called my biography, The King's Midwife, I gave it the subtitle, A History and Mystery of Madame du Coudray, because there was so much about her that I was never able to learn. I know nothing, for example, about her origins. I know nothing about her parents, nothing about her childhood. She played her cards very, very close to the chest. Only her death certificate, which I found in Bordeaux, shows that she died in 1794, was 79 years old, so you do the math and you know that she was 1715 and she was apparently a native of Paris. But really the biographical information about her before her fame is negligible. Jonathan Spence, who's a historian at Yale, a wonderful historian of Asia, said once that he thinks there's a sort of unfairness about biography, because we probe and we delve and we pry, and the subject can't fight back. Well, she fought back, and she won. There was just so much that she was determined that people not find out about her, and there are huge holes in the story that I was able to tell about her. This is no seamless cradle-to-grave, womb-to-tomb kind of biography. As a result, I wrote it in a very episodic way, sort of jumping from one stop that she made to another stop that she made, and calling attention, making a virtue of necessity, calling attention to the fact that there are these gigantic gaps and lacuna in her story. And so the very way I wrote the book makes that clear. I believe Madame du Coudray's view of embryos and of babies to be rather unique for her time. In the images that she provided for her textbook, in the life-size baby doll that she fashioned for her students to extract from the fabric mannequin of her mother's pelvis, and in the way that she wrote and didn't write about them in her letters and in her book. And I think this idiosyncratic pictorial, tactile, and textual approach to babies is a clue into both the interior life of the woman and the success of her mission. It could well be that her strenuous exertions and her fierce ambition for public recognition were a kind of compensatory flight from some perceived private failure. There is, after all, a definite irony in the fact that the national midwife was herself childless. Perhaps she had purposely placed herself safely beyond the risks of intimacy, into a life where competence and achievement took its place. Was her non-participation in what Adrian Rich calls pairing and bearing the stimulus for her boundless commitment, indeed her passion, to save babies for her patrie, her country? She appeared determined to make her work fruitful, though her body had not been, to literally deliver the goods, to make human life on a grand scale her very business. So let me go into this in a little bit more detail. Madame du Coudray, whose marriage status and last name with its coveted noble particle, the de Coudray, makes her sound like an aristocrat, was almost certainly, these were almost certainly fabrications of her. She was an expert self-fashioner. She cooked up this name. She was originally Mademoiselle Marguerite Le Boursier, one of 200 or so midwives practicing in Paris in the 1740s and 1750s. She aggressively petitioned, and I'll show you the petition next, but first let me just call attention to the portrait which appeared in her textbook. I don't know if you can see at the top, Ad Operam, to work, right? And here, Angélique Marguerite du Coudray, pensioned and sent by the king to teach the practice of midwifery throughout the realm. So she's a great advertisement for herself. And unlike portraits of other contemporary midwives, Justine Siegemunden, Louise Bourgeois, who was a century early, they tend to be very diffident sort of portraits. The gaze is down, they're dressed like nuns, and she's got on this amazing frock with its fur, and she's just looking right out at us saying, "Here I am." And she was pleased with herself, no question about it. And I think that this is very, she doesn't thank any god for the skill that she has. This is a very idiosyncratic image, actually, of a midwife in this time. I'm not going to show you a bunch of others, but take my word for it. Okay, so here we go. Forward, right?
On the right-hand side.
I've got it. Okay, so this is a petition that she signed, and you see Le Boursier, I left it in your office. I have a great laser pointer, but it doesn't matter. But do you see Le Boursier up there? The sort of the second one in from here, second line. The only midwives who were ahead of her were juried midwives from the city of Paris, and this was a job she was not at all interested in. But she spearheaded basically the other midwives. And the petition was to the medical faculty for anatomy lessons. So it's clear that she was somebody who was very, very eager to have midwives instructed in dissection and in all the sorts of things that the Paris medical faculty male teachers tried to exclude midwives from as a general rule. She also, I know from apprenticeship contracts that I found, commanded a very, very high fee for her for teaching young girls. So the other 200 midwives who practiced her, and I read a lot of contracts, would tend to take a girl in, not only teach her midwifery, but also provide room and board and do laundry and give them heat and give them light. And Madame du Coudray offered none of that. All she would do was teach her apprentices and even so would ask for a lot more money from them, although she wasn't providing these other services. So even then, she had acquired a pretty lofty reputation among the large group of midwives in the capital. Something made her leave Paris very precipitously, and she moved to Auvergne, right in the center of France. The center of France where the Dietrich obstetrical model is apparently from, is that right? And it was there that she basically, that her transformation from private practice to sort of public service began to evolve. Previously sheltered from the blood and gore of rural delivery, she was altogether shocked by what she saw and heard from her clients in the countryside around Clermont, which is the main town in Auvergne. The women communicated to her in a variety of ways the climate of terror and dread, the constant menace of pain and death surrounding childbirth. Stories abounded of misshapen heads squeezed, then clumsily remolded by some desperate matron. The number of village idiots was very high. Useless shrunken limbs, broken backs, eyes rendered sightless by a jagged, dirty fingernail during delivery, and of course, death. These mothers fully expected many of their babies to die. Du Coudray was naturally very devoted to the mothers who confided in her and put themselves in her care, but more and more she felt called to be their teacher, to impart to them the latest anatomical understanding and obstetrical techniques that she had learned in Paris, so they would no longer be at the mercy of what she called blind, ignorant routine. She offered to give these courses for free, and women flocked to them. Compassion and zeal, she explained, led her to try to avert the infinite calamities that she now witnessed or heard about every day. Though quite sophisticated in her own training, she seemed remarkably able to gain the trust and to reach and to teach these unlettered rustics, and the majority of women that she taught were entirely illiterate. Understanding that she would need to, quote, speak to their eyes and senses rather than to their intellects, She made her classes palpable and interactive by inventing this mannequin for her purposes, to practice their, so that the students could practice their maneuvers. A life-size female pelvis, constructed of bones, wicker, fabric, wood, metal, leather, strings, sponges, whatever was necessary. And there was quite a range in the mannequins that she produced, with a full-term baby doll of cloth inside, who had to be safely extracted from every imaginable presentation. I don't know if we can dim the lights at all. So this is the mannequin that. Oh, how lovely! Thank you. Well, I don't even have to point here. This is the mannequin, and this is another view of it. And this is the one that exists in the museum in Rouen that I mentioned before, and I can't resist telling you a story about this. The Musée Flaubert is a museum of the history of medicine, and whenever I'm anywhere near a museum of the history of medicine, I go to it. And I didn't really have any idea what was in this museum. And there was a guard, it wasn't a real, I mean, there weren't a lot of people there, so the guard was taking me through, just singly. And there were rooms of beautiful apothecary jars. They were just stunning things. And then we walk into a room and I see this thing in the distance, like on a far wall. And I knew instantly what this was. And I just burst into tears. So imagine, and I had dealt with hundreds of her letters. I mean, seeing her writing, you know, it moved me, of course, but I had pulled myself together when it came to the correspondence. But I saw this thing, and I fell apart. And the guard thought he had a lunatic on his hands. You can imagine. And so, of course, then I explained to him what was happening and, you know, why this was just so extraordinary for me. And then he ended up giving me a slide of it, and so that it had a happy ending. But I just remember that. I think back on that poor man when he saw me just dissolve, you know, because she stitched this thing. She and her domestics stitched this thing and hundreds of others like it. And I didn't ever imagine that I would see one in the cloth, so to speak. Okay. So anyway, this is her machine, which dramatically enhanced the effectiveness and the fame of her teaching. She began to refer to this model as a machine, and Pam's exhibit next door makes very clear that that's a term that was used quite a bit in British midwifery. I haven't seen it really in French midwifery. But she being very enterprising, she took it to Paris, and she received the resounding approval of the Academy of Surgery there, saying that they thought this was an indispensable pedagogical tool. Before long, authorities in Versailles heard of her charisma and her ambition and the extraordinary results that she had training large numbers of midwifery students, and she was encouraged to write up her lessons as a textbook. And here we have the title page of her textbook, L'abrégé de l'art, whoops, it's on the ceiling, a little bit of it, but anyway, L'abrégé de l'art des accouchements means abridgment of the art of childbirth. And she was extraordinarily proud of this thing because before, as I say, her lessons had just been informal. And then the volume of praise for her from regional royal administrators increased, and the king eventually gave the order for this mission of hers to just basically go everywhere and try to arrest infant mortality, nothing less. Single-handedly, she was supposed to take her teaching nationwide. She was to be the monarch's ambassadress of birthing. It was during this time that she assumed her new name and her new persona, Madame du Coudray, an expert matriarch of noble lineage, with even a new first name, Angélique, right, to suggest her capacity as an angelic guardian and savior. In Paris, because her first name was Marguerite, there was no Angélique anywhere on anything. In Paris, it was fine to be a spinster, midwife. Many of them were maiden ladies, but to be taken seriously in the provinces, she would have to appear as an unmarried woman, as a married woman who had experienced things herself, who embodied maternity fully, who had felt in her own flesh these labors that she was talking about to others. Once she undertook her mission, her rhetoric became increasingly patriotic. She and her trainee disciples were to see to the multiplication of subjects for the king. Although the death of a child was a terrible thing, birth accidents were even sadder. Being crippled or blinded or deafened or mentally stunted and therefore useless to the state, this was the true tragedy. Mothers needed to be protected from sloppy procedures that might make them sterile, and of course fertility had to be enhanced but mostly the safe delivery of the baby had to be assured. Nothing could be left to chance. The image of the midwife and her trade was to be rehabilitated. Midwives' work was not folkloric, but enlightened, not secretive, but transparent, not haphazard, but professional. And this is an example of one of the certificates. Is the focus okay? I can't tell from here. This is, I think, from the city of Besançon. But after taking her two-month course, she was given permission by the king to dispense certificates of this kind, which totally short-circuited the usual practice of needing to appear before a board of doctors to be approved, and there was a big, long exam, and you had to do a live birth, and there were all sorts of very rigorous approval procedures, and her certificate sufficed. For her trainees, her certificate sufficed. Now, they had been in the course for 2 months, 6 days a week, all day long, listening to her, having her illustrate things with the kinds of images that you'll see in her textbook, and use, of course, this mannequin, and practice again and again and again on the mannequin. The machine, as she called it, caused her to generalize about women's bodies in very impersonal terms. Working constantly on this objectified pelvis, the animate individual, the person in the patient, the organic whole with its soul, necessarily started to fade. Women continued to seek her help, but now more as students than birthing mothers. And what the machine had started, the authorship of the textbook compounded, changing her from a humanitarian healer into a political actor and patriot. In the dedication of her book to the Intendant of Auvergne, the Intendants were, there were 30 of them in the various provinces sent by the king to basically do his bidding. They were administrators directly connected to royalty. If the king was displeased with them for any reason, he could move them, he could fire them. And she was authorized to tell Versailles whether certain people in these provinces had cooperated with her or not. And so in my book, I have all sorts of stories about places where she ran into very refractory officials who really were determined to make her miserable. She didn't allow them to do that, but they sure tried. And others who bent over backwards to facilitate things for her. So it's an interesting kind of relationship that she had. But she dedicated her book to the Intendant of Auvergne, who was somebody who was very supportive. And she stated, "It is no less glorious to watch over the conservation of His Majesty's subjects in the bosom of his realm than to chase from his frontiers and destroy the enemies of his state." Thus, support for her work was as important as victory in battle. She is up there in loyalty and importance with military generals, sustaining and defending her country. They kill foes while she repairs, restores, and most of all, preserves life. They do warfare, she does welfare, arresting the population decline. Genuine sympathy with Auvergne's pauvres malheureuses, the poor unfortunate women, has grown into the clear sense that safe delivery of their offspring, of healthy future citizens, is absolutely crucial for the nation. As Ducoudray as her focus shifts from mother to baby, her tone shifts from sentimental to soldierly. The abrégé is activist, interventionist, bold, a how-to manual, allowing her to do and to train her subjects, her students to do, the monarch's bidding. She was publishing her lessons, as she put it, quote, "less out of presumption, which 20 years of experience might have inspired in me, than out of the desire to make herself useful to her country." And let me show you now a map of her mission. That's France, and she covered it. There's kind of a code up there to show you that the first part of her mission was sort of in the interior. This went on for 3 decades. Because she would come to a town, she would set up, she would teach a course for about 2 months or 2.5 months. Then, if there was huge demand, like over 100 students, she would teach a second one, but of course she required 15 days to rest afterwards and 15 days to get herself together before the next one. So she cost the Intendant plenty of money. But anyway, she did the internal part of France, then she did the periphery of France, and then toward the end, the last, I don't know if you can see, you know, the difference in the lines, but toward the end she was just kind of treading water here in Burgundy, waiting to come down to the south of France. These were cities that turned her away. These were cities very hostile to the king. They didn't want the king's midwife there. And so this squiggly mark is a period when we just lose track of her for about 14... Oh, I'm in my own way, sorry. But for about 14 or 15 months, we have no clue where she is.
She's trying to settle and give courses in these towns, and they're not allowing her to. So obviously she didn't write letters about that period because it was a very displeasing period for her, as you can imagine. Her work and the good of the nation become one and the same for her. She calls her work the bien de l'humanité, the good of humanity. And for over a quarter of a century, this woman, already in her 40s when she sets out, systematically covers France. She and her cadre of students are delivering for the state. Indeed, they are delivering the state itself. A populous nation is a prosperous nation, and the countless babies saved by her teaching and the perpetuation of her method will allow France's renewal after the humiliation and devastation of the Seven Years' War, and she talks about this constantly in her letters. Here is an aggressive stance against resignation and fatalism. Babies do not have to die. She will be a vector of progress, responsible for the flourishing of the nation's most valuable product and resource. More and more in her letters, she conflates le bien with les biens. So singular, it means the good. Plural, it means goods. And she's conflating the moral and the monetary. Basically, babies are worth a lot, as she says. They are precious treasures. They are treasures of great price, valuable, dear, in both senses of the word, to the state. They are an investment in France's glorious future. I want to illustrate her uniquely pragmatic attitude toward babies, her increasing loyalty to them over the mother, in a number of ways. First, she persistently used the transitive form of the verb to deliver, accoucher, rather than the much more common reflexive s'accoucher. And let me tell you why that's interesting. In the countryside, birthing assistants practicing mutual aid speak of helping the mother to deliver herself of her burden. Country women want to be involved in getting this kid out. They want to control it. They want to watch it. They want to see their own deliverance from the 9 months or so of bondage. They want freedom and relief from captivity. They have sheltered, harbored, carried this baby long enough, and if anything goes wrong now, it is never the mother's fault. That stillborn just wasn't meant to live. Okay? They use almost exclusively vertical positions. The mother is sitting or kneeling, upright or on all fours, standing, crouching, squatting, jumping even. But in all cases, being able to follow the baby's pulses and changes and watch the process and help that baby come down and emerge between her taut, sweaty legs. In French country practice, it seems that women never lie down. That would restrict their freedom of motion and distance them from the event in which they want to play a major part. If ever there is a choice between saving one of the two, it is always the mother who wins over the baby. Babies are expected to die anyway. By contrast, Ducoudray and her students are active while the mother is passive. Ducoudray and the midwives she trains must accouche the mother. They must deliver and intervene and do things to her so this baby can be piloted to safety by the art. They deploy techniques and constant ministrations to facilitate his smooth and slippery exit from his prison. Saving the baby takes primacy. One must never, says Ducoudray, abandon a child. They use exclusively horizontal positions, lying the mother down, flat on a bed, where she cannot see and is rather removed and disengaged from goings on below. She is referred to now as la malade, the patient. This position has the advantage that the midwife can be very comfortable, can see exactly what's going on, and can do her challenging, dexterous work unencumbered. Even a simple, straightforward birth, Ducoudray argues, is a tricky thing requiring constant vigilance. Although great science is not necessary, this is a quote, although great science is not necessary in natural delivery, there are still plenty of precautions to take during labor to ensure that favorable beginnings do not end badly, unquote. Significantly, fully half of Madame Ducoudray's book deals with unnatural delivery, with malpresentations and malformations, the challenge of getting babies in bad positions out safely, around the obstacle course that is the mother's internal structure, in particular the pelvic basin and the pubic bone. Extracting a misplaced baby, in many cases, is physically, mechanically impossible, so it must be therefore moved and turned so that it can be delivered safely. Numerous lessons teach the students how to turn the baby through a combination of external and internal pressure after detecting, by means of touch, that it is presenting abnormally, a shoulder, elbow, stomach, chest, heel, hand, knee, chin, whatever. Nearly all of these presentations require pedalic version and footling breech delivery, but with knowledge of anatomy and practiced skills, all can still end well. Most of this reduces to clever, deft, speedy, confident maneuvers that Yukudre's students learn to engineer in their repeated practice on her machine. She tells them that village matrons, unaware of these realities, watch countless babies perish unnecessarily and, quote, need to separate the head or use hooks and ladles to go in and get the rest of the body out in pieces. She wants to impress her students with the dire consequences of any ineptitude on their part, and doesn't hesitate to spell it out very, very graphically for them. She also speaks at great length about another obligation of the midwife, choosing a good nourrice or wet nurse. The nurse's character traits will almost surely be passed on through her breast milk to the baby that she suckles. So she must be upstanding and virtuous, and of course physically robust. Every precaution must be taken so that at the critical juncture when the midwife surrenders responsibility for the newborn, she will have nothing to reproach herself. Pages are devoted to this in the textbook. And subsequent editions dwell on it still more. The complexion, the breath, living habits, nipple size of the wet nurse must be scrutinized. And, of course, her milk's taste and viscosity. The new little life must be entrusted to someone who will keep it alive and continue the hard work of the midwife. There are numerous other ways in which we see Ducoudray's primary focus on the baby, some of which her contemporaries noticed and commented on. The intendant of the city of Poitiers remarked at one point that her students are taught to concentrate almost exclusively on the product. Quote, they know how to deliver like a cobbler knows how to make shoes, and that's all what matters. Okay? It seemed to him that hardly any lessons dealt with the mother and her needs. Ducoudray almost always gave her lessons in the great room of the Hôtel de Ville, the city town hall. And here's the one in Chalon-sur-Marne, where she had a huge success. Something like 27 or 30 of these machines were ordered for the towns around the main city, Chalon. And so she had no scruples whatsoever about teaching in such a place. This was, of course, a public building. In principle, anyone of either sex could wander in, but she was very down-to-earth and very pragmatic, and it suited her because the space could accommodate the huge crowds wishing to learn at her feet. Later, when her adopted niece, and I said before she had no children, so she conveniently adopted an apprentice who she thought was very skilled and made her her niece, the niece is fascinating. There's a whole book to be written on her if anybody's looking for a topic, because she founded the maternity hospital in Bordeaux, and she's amazing. But anyway, she wouldn't teach in such a public place. She thought it was not decorous and not okay. And so this is the town hall in Sarlat in Dordogne. I'm sorry about the cars. They spoil the 18th century mood. Just forget about the cards. But this was the city hall of Sarlat, where Madame Coutanceau, the niece, refused to teach. So again, there were different ways of sort of approaching this. But Ducoudray didn't have any scruples of that kind. And in fact, at one point, late in the mission, she agreed to give courses for about a year at the Royal Veterinary College outside of Paris. The king decided that animal doctors were to be trained to deliver human babies because in many far-flung and desolate regions of the country, vets were the only medical practitioners around. While some of Madame Ducoudray's fans and supporters found this somewhat outrageous, she herself saw it as admirably practical and acquiesced with no apparent reluctance. That it might offend the sensibility of mothers to be delivered by those who tend their horses and cows just never seemed to cross her mind. Sometimes Ducoudray is actually directly critical of mothers, as when she discusses their vain desire to have beautiful children and their misguided requests that the presiding midwife reshape their offspring at birth to enhance certain characteristics. It is common in the country for a newborn, considered still unformed in some sense, to be pushed and stretched and flattened and molded very, very aggressively. If it's a girl, its nipples are pulled. It's pinched and pressed and poked where dimples should go. If it's a boy, its umbilical cord is left longer, and other manipulations are performed to encourage the penis to, quote, grow to good measure. Madame Ducoudray sees these practices as terribly dangerous, increasing the ranks of, quote, the imbeciles, the deaf, and the maimed. She instructs her students to keep mothers in check when they plead with them to, quote, repair the defects of nature, to shape the head, to make it rounder, to fix the nose, etc. Mothers must be brought to their senses and not request such lethal cosmetic procedures, which invariably end in atrocities and cost the state countless useful subjects. Now, I want to turn to the illustrations that Madame Ducoudray did in her textbook, and I'll give you a tiny sneak preview here. Do I have, like, 5 more minutes?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. This is 4 of them, and I'll show them to you closer up, you know, one at a time. But I just want to say that she was extraordinarily proud of these illustrations, and they appeared for the first time. There were 6 editions of her book, one in Flemish, by the way. They first appeared in the edition of 1769 and in all the subsequent ones. In 1767, she had received a special brevet, or sort of pension, from the king, promising her a steady salary of 8,000 livres, not only while she taught, but also in retirement. And just to give you an idea, my husband, who's sitting here, always says, well, what was that worth back then? You know, what does that number mean? Well, I can tell you that this was the pension for retired military generals. So this was a lot of money. But no sooner did she get the news than she invested nearly half of it, her own earnings, to have 26 images engraved for her book. And these were so costly because they employed a revolutionary color technique, the very latest in print technology, a sort of multi-chrome process of inking successive copper plates in red and then yellow and then blue and then black, and printing the image 4 times in superposition. And the result is very arresting and very fresh and very beautiful. And she said that she wanted her pictures to be frappant, striking, to make her mission luminous and lasting. So now, Jim's probably dying over there because he knows how many slides I have, and I've already been talking for 40 minutes. But I'm going to just sort of zip through a bunch of slides now because I want to say some things, some comparative things about her pictures as opposed to others, and I won't be dwelling at length on any one of them. So I am sort of almost done, but I need about 5 minutes. Okay. So the first thing that I want to say, somebody's chuckling there, but I think I can do it in 5 minutes. This will be speedy. Okay, so this is a very, very typical engraving. What I'm trying to point out to you is this was such a patriarchal culture. We think of the Enlightenment, and especially the French Enlightenment, as extraordinarily progressive. But this was a man's world, big time. So this is a jubilant scene where it is being announced to the father that he has a son. C'est un fils, okay? You don't see pictures like this when a daughter is born. None, okay? So is this in focus, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. So this is just to kind of set the scene for what I'm going to run through right now. Okay, now the crowning glory of the French Enlightenment was the Encyclopédie, a 17-volume encyclopedia done in the third quarter of the 18th century, spearheaded by Denis Diderot and by D'Alembert, although he split because it was too much for him. And this was a very, very daring thing. It also has 11 volumes of plates of illustrations. So I want to show you the illustrations of the men and the women in the encyclopedia, just to sort of set the stage here. Okay, so this is one of the drawings of a man, muscular, hand up in the air, full of strength. This is another drawing of a man. This has nothing to do with obstetrics, okay? But here he is thinking deeply, still muscular, but thinking deeply. And here are the two corresponding ones of women. So, you know, the fig leaf, she's looking crestfallen, downtrodden, unhappy, ashamed. The vaginal area was referred to, as you'll see in an illustration that I'm going to show you in 3 minutes. They were referred to in France as the parties honteuses, the shameful parts. Okay. And this is another picture of a woman equally sad, it seems to me. And this is the picture from the encyclopedia of a womb. Flayed and horrible to behold. I don't even know how they got it to look like this, but this is the illustration in the Encyclopédie of the womb. Okay, so the womb clearly has a tremendous metaphoric weight in this period, and others. Most of you in this room, I'm sure, know, but for the few of you who might not, later on, the wandering womb is thought to cause hysteria. The Greek word for the uterus is hystera. Okay, so a hysterectomy get that thing out, and the woman will not be hysterical anymore. You know? So, in other words, the womb is considered extremely problematic. So what do obstetricians who decide to illustrate their treatise do with this womb? Okay. So this is an illustration from a Frenchman named Guillemot. In fairness, he was a couple centuries earlier. He's a 16th century guy. But nonetheless, this was what he thought was a helpful illustration in his book on childbirth. Okay? We've got this thing, well, I don't know, this lumbering, oafish thing that looks more like a grown-up, but certainly not like a baby, floating around in a womb which has been tamed and subdued, basically, into this kind of flask shape. And you're going to see that a lot. This is by Morisseau, who's famous for the Morisseau maneuver, which some of you in this room probably know about, but I'll mention it again in a minute. And this is just the bizarre picture. You know, we've got the intact woman with her breasts. We've got her arms chopped off like so much steak. We've got her insides showing too. And Morisseau, who's now going to show you the, I'm going to show you his picture of the partie honteuse. Oh, it's off the screen. But down here, it says this is the entrance to the womb, commonly called the partie honteuse, the shameful part. Okay. So this is Morisseau, one of the great male writers on this subject, and this is the kind of illustration that you see in his book on childbirth. This is Gautier d'Agoty, a French contemporary of Madame de Coudray, who again does these sort of eviscerated women, but the upper body is intact. And now you're going to see one of my favorites. The baby's been born now, but why not take him apart too? Right? Well, let's see what he looks like inside. Why not? I mean, so many of these are kind of off topic. It cracks me up. But anyway, okay, so that's Gautier d'Agoty. Now, the next couple I'm going to show you are by a man named De Venter, who was actually Dutch, and I'm probably mangling his name in Dutch, but his work was translated into French and circulating wildly when Madame de Coutelet wrote. And he, too, has this kind of flask-shaped womb. At least there's the suggestion that it's somewhat near the spine. But other than that, it's just floating there, just sort of there, like a subdued jar, okay, in which these babies are just sort of cavorting. This is another one by Deventer. Now, this is not going to work real well with the baby facing forward, but he doesn't say that. He has this picture there. Madame de Coudray is going to have such a picture, too, but it's going to be just plastered with warnings, as you'll see. This guy looks perfectly happy. He doesn't know what's in store. Okay, now is this weird? What is this? Some triumphant thing? This is the hand in the womb. Nothing, he's not going after the placenta. Nothing doing. Just sort of claiming it territorially. I don't know what this picture. Maybe in discussion you can tell me what you think this picture is. But I show it because to me it's so absurd. All right? There isn't that kind of space in there. I don't really know the point of it. And the text doesn't help, the text that accompanies this in Deventer's book. Okay, now just real quick, this is another French doctor, Viardel, whose work was very popular at the time that Madame de Coudray was writing. And he does this, he really wants to show his muscularity. You'll see more in another picture. And this baby is just, this is fun. I'm coming out. This is easy. There's all the room in the world. No problem. I find these pictures very funny. This, not okay, right? And here, well, you know, he's at least going in for the feet. He's going in for the feet, which is a good thing, but look at him, right? This is about him. This is not really about that baby. Okay, so now I want to switch to her just real quick. I'm a little over five. I'm sorry. Two more minutes, Jim? Okay, so this is very typical of Madame de Coudray. This is that same breech birth that we saw before with no warning. Look at all the writing on her illustration. This is all about how absolutely awful this is going to be when the baby's chin gets stuck. Okay? So it's all about how this, and I don't have time to read the text, but it's about how this baby should never have been pulled out this far. It has to be turned around. Its face has to be backward toward the mother's spine. Then there's maybe a chance that this is going to be okay. But all of these comments that she makes on different pictures, here somebody's going in to grab I can't tell if it's an arm or a leg, and it's always described as an ignorant hand or a hand with great temerity and no prudence, which is this wonderful French word, you know, having to do with caution and safety. Okay, that's not going to work either. This isn't going to, they're trying to pull it out by an arm. Okay, not okay. Here, the baby is, you know, nothing bad has happened yet. And by the way, notice the only white thing in these pictures is the midwife's cuffs, this lovely, blousy, clean cuff. There's no discussion in this period of cleanliness, but the cuffs, the laundry has to look good, okay? So this baby is going to be turned in a way that will end in prompt decapitation, see, prompt here. And this is, happens very souvent dans la campagne, very frequently in the countryside, but people just have no idea of the obstacle course inside. This looks like it'd be okay, but it's not, because this baby's head has been pulled up too soon. And so you see the little foreshortened face there? You see the face? Mm-hmm. Okay, this baby is stuck. The shoulders are stuck. This is a disaster. And here we have a good thing. This hand is going in, and so you see much less text, by the way, because this is going in to get the feet. Okay, this might actually work out okay. And here we see Morisot's maneuver. So the baby, it's a breech birth, but the baby is facing backwards. The hand that you see behind the baby is going in to find the tongue and push down on the tongue and dislodge the jaw and push down on the occiput, and this baby's going to be okay. And finally, this is a perfectly nice, lovely, happy ending type of birth. Okay, but relatively few pictures of this kind in her manual. Mostly it's about danger, caution, and things that can go horribly wrong. Okay, now this is almost the end. So here, I'm sorry that this is off the screen, but this is Viardel, the guy with the big muscles and the tiny baby. The baby's out already, and he's going in after the placenta. And again, there's just all the room in the world in there, right? Look at her picture of the placenta, of going, having to go, if it doesn't come out by itself, okay? She, and this whole thing is about how you have to go in. It's very tight, as you see. And you have to introduce one finger at a time against the wall there to dislodge this so that no parts are left. And hers is just totally explicit and cautious about how to get that thing out if it hasn't just popped out by itself. This is Viardel on the subject of twins. Don't they look happy? All the room in the world, once again, okay? This is Madame Ducoudray on twins. This is a catastrophe, because some stupid midwife with her temerity has found a left leg and a right leg and is yanking. But they belong to two different babies, which she has not established, okay? So it's all about being careful. Her whole textbook is about the need for these precautions. This is kind of horrible. But again, you know, his fingers look all dainty. Hers is much, I think, much more eloquent of a case where the baby has come out and the head hasn't come with it. Look at hers. The neck is torn. See the little ridges there? Not much to say. Okay, and then here's a picture of everything just fine, copacetic, and everything is labeled. And finally, here she is again. And this is another picture of the mannequin in Rouen that reduced me to tears. And I think I will stop with that.
Thank you so much, Nina.
You're welcome.
We can go with a 10-minute question and answer, and then I think we should adjourn to go into the gallery where we get some refreshments and go see the exhibit that Pam curated for us. So open the floor. Turn on the lights. Oh, yes, I'm sure. Thanks, Tom.
Well, I'm curious because I've always studied American midwifery, and there's a sense of everybody having an apprentice who follows, and then it's finally to a point of being trained. So before you have these specialists, and I mean, this is quite different from anything I've
this,
heard.
She's a singular phenomenon.
Well, you have the idea of several midwives signing a petition and going, and it's also so much more regulated in some ways. Mm-hmm. Did you have individual midwives? In the United States, they're supposed to be quite successful, even in the colonial period. Wow. So people apprenticing one at a time, and this idea of massive classes is... Mm-hmm.
But that was peculiar to her. So, for example, when she signed the petition, This was when she was still one of a large group of Parisian midwives. But she wanted them, I mean, she in that sense, she represented this group of practicing midwives because she wanted them to have the proper kind of training, the kind of, you know, she wanted them to be able to watch a dissection, for example. She herself had somehow had access to this, but she wanted other midwives, even Parisian midwives who tended to be somewhat sophisticated, she wanted them to be exposed to the kind of training that the surgeons were getting. And so she sort of organized this. But each of those midwives that you saw who signed there, and those were the ones who could sign, there were a lot who just did X's, they did have this more one-on-one kind of thing that you're talking about. And these apprenticeship contracts that I looked at, they were very much obligations between a person who was trained, a person who was untrained, going around together, and that and the young person, the younger person, learning in that manner.
So
that was the tradition. And her teaching these gigantic classes, it's totally exceptional. It's because she was given this mission by the king, and she functioned in an entirely different way. She didn't, after she became famous and was given this job to do, she didn't take individual apprentices anymore. Hers was really sort of a roadshow. It was a spectacle. Trumpets announced her arrival at the town. All the parish priests had to select young girls who they thought would be suitable to come and take her course, and she taught hundreds at a time.
I have a couple of questions. The questions will be short, but I don't think the answers are. Where did she get the anatomic specimens? Who did the drawings? Was there any hint of anything that even unlimitedly resembled a sepsis among those white sleeves and cuffs? And lastly, was her work known to John and William Hunter, to Spelly, and others? 200 miles away across the
channel. I'd love to say yes, but I don't believe so. I was talking to Jim earlier about another woman that I'm working on, an anatomist who was a wax modeler in France named Mademoiselle Bierron, and she did go twice to London, and she certainly knew Hunter when he was putting his pictures together. But my midwife lady, I don't believe, was known to him. And then as far as infection goes, it isn't something that she deals with in her textbook at all. But as we know, people, you know, cleanliness was not yet next to godliness. I mean, there just wasn't that much.
I look at, you know, perhaps as a womanly trait more than anything that had to do with hygiene.
The clean cuffs.
Where did she get the anatomic specimen?
I'm not sure who her artist was. That's not clear. I do know who the man was who did her color prints, because that was just such an exceptional process at the time. But she doesn't, I mean, there is a name, the name of the designer, the drawer, the draftsman is there, but it doesn't mean anything to any of my art historian friends. So she certainly was not above, you know, grave robbing, and she used, in fact, in the Rouen mannequin, this one, which has been x-rayed, as has Jim's now, the one at the Dittrich, shows that this is a real bone pelvis inside here. But other times she needed to use wicker and wood and you know, other substances. But I mean, your question, I've asked myself that a whole lot. You know, what was the incidence of sepsis? I'm sure there was some, but it wasn't something she advertised, and it doesn't seem to have been a really major problem.
Oh, pretty fast after this. I mean, 19th century. Her niece, who I mentioned, who started the maternity hospital in Bordeaux, she really fought for midwives to somehow capture and keep the status that Madame de Coutet's mission had given them, because she very much put them on the map. But the male accoucheur was really taking over.
So the certificate didn't last.
Well, actually, if you read the surveys that were done during the Revolution, the sort of public health surveys, huge numbers of people referred to her courses or to being trained by somebody who had been trained by her. So yes, I suppose it lasted into the early 19th century. Certainly in 1789, 1791, when these surveys were done, she's very much mentioned. But these certificates, since you brought them up, created a huge amount of trouble, as you can imagine. When she went back to a town where there was already a village matron whose claim to fame was that she had 10 babies, but she didn't know anything about what she was doing, really, except for experience. And those people, those older matrons, who had the confidence of a lot of the women in the small village, you know, and in that sense played a very significant role, were horrified by these upstarts who, after 2 months of training, came with this piece of paper, you know. So the stories of what it was like for her trainees to go back to their little towns, they're fairly hair-raising, actually.
Pelvic deformity, does she have any recognition of it? Because I didn't see much she did.
Yeah, they all look pretty good, don't they?
I know.
Yeah.
No, with the illustrations. Because it seems like, you know, the 1770s, 1780s, right. You know, there's so much more attention to pelvic deformity and cutting symphysis pubis.
Doesn't talk about it at all.
Yeah.
Hmm. Was she aware of it? Sure. Did she give abortive remedies to some of these women? I'm sure. But as the king's midwife, who was supposed to enhance the population, it was not something that she spoke about. Certainly not in the textbook, and not even in her letters. But I mean, she obviously knew that stuff, and she, you know, must have been trusted in that capacity too, as somebody who could advise a poor mother who just didn't want to have any more kids. You know, she must have had secrets of that sort. But no, she doesn't talk about deformed mothers, deformed babies, yes.
I think with that we could adjourn and continue the conversation individually while we look at the gallery. Well, thank you.